Thank you, Judge. I am Roger Jotko at 020346, and with me is Mr. Ed Dower. We represent the appellate Aspen. If I may reserve 5 minutes, try to reserve 5 minutes for a reply, if any.
The yellow light will go on when you have 5 minutes left.
Thank you, sir. We believe that this case is a lot simpler than it looks. We have we have taken the ultimately the position that this is a non-tort claim. In other words, there's a Consumer Protection Act claim, which is not a tort. There is a misrepresentation claim, which is not a tort. It is, in this context, a contractual claim. The reason for that is that the parties were involved in a continuous, the putative class, if I may call them the parties. They were involved in a continuous, regular gas purchase. Kinder Morgan, it is Kinder, was selling to them on a regular basis. So we see it as a contractual dispute and a Consumer Protection Act claim.
There's no contract claim pleaded, though, is there?
No, nor is there a tort claim pleaded.
What's the definition of, when you say no tort claim pleaded, does the name of the heading have to say tort?
Obviously, that would be helpful, but if you can look at the complaint with me or make a note, it's Exhibit Attachment A to the opening brief. The complaint, in its claim for relief, claims under the Deceptive Trade Practices Consumer Protection Act. I don't think there's much question about that claim.
And well, in fact, I guess, why not? I mean, if they're based on misrepresentations or fraud, those are different than contract claims and generally viewed as tort claims, are they not?
Yes. If I may, there's a case that there are a lot of cases that seem to be dealing with these issues, and I don't know if the court has the advantage of this one, which was decided in our Colorado District Court February 9th. It's called Torres and American Family. I can give a Westlaw citation, but that's all there is.
If it's a Colorado District Court case, I'm sure we don't have it.
The Westlaw citation is 2009 WL310889. The way that the cases have been interpreted, I think, is well expressed by Judge Krieger. This is at the fourth page I have. What Sweeney teaches, that is decision of this this court, what Sweeney teaches is that the court must evaluate whether a, quote, tort action has been pled by examining the face of the pleading, not the underlying logic of the claims. C. Robinson and Colorado State Lottery, which we'll talk about in a minute. It makes the plaintiff a master of his pleading. If the plaintiff chooses to plead claims in tort, he runs the risk of 201 applying. If he wishes to avoid the application of the statute, he must refrain from pleading tort claims. And so what we're saying here, I guess, is that we have refrained from pleading tort claims, and we are not subject to 1317-201.
Well, again, if you look at, I'm not sure where the line is here. Do we look at just the name of the claim, or do we look at the substance and the type of relief that's sought? Okay. Obviously, if you're seeking some sort of contractual remedy, regardless of what the claim is called, I can understand why that would be would sound in contract, regardless of what you called it. But if you're seeking a remedy along the lines of based on misrepresentation separate from a fraudulent inducement claim, that strikes me as more of a tort. So I guess I'm not understanding your argument on, okay, on how do we know when something is a tort claim versus a contract claim. And maybe you're telling me it's just we have to look at the title and look for the word tort.
That's one thing I would tell you. Let me tell you what happened in
Is that your argument? I mean, do we have to look, if the name of tort is not in the title, is that the end of our analysis?
No, I think the nature of the relief can be of assistance, too.
Okay.
In the Torres case, which I just cited, there were two claims. a breach of duty of reasonable care and breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing. To me, the essence of a tort claim, excuse me, is a breach of duty. The essence of a contract claim is a breach of an agreement. And why I say this is a contractual claim, even though it's titled misrepresentation, is that in the context and between the parties, there was a continuous contractual relationship. If there had been none, we would have been thrust into claiming for a breach of duty of some kind, which is a tort claim in my submission. So
it's essentially a deceptive trade practice that you're arguing, right?
Yes.
And you say...
I mean, there's no question. Sorry.
You're saying your complaint that they acted knowing that the delivered natural gas, have systematically and falsely represented the characteristics and the quality. In another paragraph, 5, defendant's fraudulent conduct is actionable. Aren't you arguing fraud and misrepresentation?
What we rely on, and this is in the reply brief, so I don't want to read it, we rely on a decision of our Supreme Court, Crow versus Tull. And in that decision, the Supreme Court made the difference between torts and consumer protection claims clear. We're citing to pages 208 and to 210. And what the court explained was that there cannot be a private action under the Consumer Protection Act. The contest in Crow and Tull was between a Consumer Protection Act claim, a contest, if you will, and a legal malpractice claim, which is a tort. The court explained claims are not duplicative, even though they may have the same elements of fraud and misrepresentation. They are different claims, and one is not duplicative of the other. And that's why we say our consumer protection claims are not tort claims.
Well, certainly the consumer protection claim has to have an additional element that there be harm to the public generally.
Sure.
I think that's what Crow says.
I agree.
But I'm not sure that that means that any claim brought under this statute is not a tort claim.
Well,
it just adds an element that you have to plead and prove in order to prevail under the statute.
That is what our argument is that this is a non-tort claim.
Is it your position that merely because one of the claims is statutory, it can't be a tort claim?
This particular statutory claim, yes.
Okay. All right.
Under our Supreme Court ruling, yes.
Okay.
That's my position. And the misrepresentation claim, I mean, that to me, if you're going to analyze it fully, would depend on looking at the context of the claims of overall action as a in the relationship between the parties. If nobody labels it a breach of contract, we say that we are entitled to, we can't escape the mandatory provisions of 201 because we did not affirmatively plead a tort. In other words, what I guess part of the argument we're making in the briefs is that simply because we do not plead a breach of contract, that you do not need to plead the breach of contracts expressly in order to avoid these mandatory provisions. So the yellow light didn't come on.
It'll come on at 5 minutes. Oh, you have good. 5 minutes and 44 seconds left.
Okay.
You can reserve that time if you would like.
Yes, I'd like to do that, if I may.
May.
Unless you have other questions at the moment. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Jack Llewellyn. My bar number is number 29017. And I represent the appellees, the defendants below, which have been collectively referred to throughout as Kinder Morgan. from our vantage point, this is a simple case and comes down to one simple issue. Do the mandatory fee provisions of Section 201 apply to the dismissal of Aspen's complaint pursuant to Rule 12b-1? Because that's the issue, it seems to me that the analysis should start and should end with the statute. When we walk through the statute, there are certain criteria that have to be met, and I think when you walk through the statute, you'll see that each criteria is satisfied, and the district court properly awarded Kinder Morgan its attorney's fees after
this, the statute, meaning 1317-201?
Yes, sir. The first requirement under Section 201 is that there be an action brought as a result of injury. Don't think there's any dispute there. Aspen brought a claim seeking damages from Kinder Morgan. The second element is that the action be occasioned by tort. It's clear that this complaint, the allegations made by Aspen against Kinder Morgan, were occasioned by tort, and we reached that conclusion for several reasons. First, if you look at the complaint itself, as your honors were mentioning earlier, this is a tort claim. I mean, it's fraud and misrepresentation. There's no allegation of a breach of contract. There's no claim of breach of contract. In fact, I dare say that as you go through the complaint, you barely see, if at all, a contract mentioned. Rather, the complaint talks about a scheme to defraud, conduct to misrepresent. And certainly, the word tort does not appear in the second claim for relief for misrepresentation. But a tort is a tort. And there really are two types of relief. There are contract claims, and there are tort claims. And this certainly wasn't pled as a breach of contract.
Mr. Lewin, can I ask you to address, and I think you're doing this, but the phrase occasioned by tort, of course, isn't defined, so I'd be curious on your take on what that means. And I'd like you, if you would, to address the Robinson case. The case is a little bit troubling to me because the court, on the one hand, the Supreme Court in that case said, the claims there did not lie it was focused on the lie or couldn't lie in tort. Mm-hmm. Said for purposes of the Colorado Government Immunity Act, it did, but for purposes of 1317-201, it didn't. So could you address those issues?
Absolutely. And to get to the first question, I'm going to go through Robinson and then talk about Aztec Minerals.
Thank you.
In Robinson, The plaintiff sued the lottery and set forth a number of claims for relief, contract claims, specifically designated contract claims. The court first analyzed under the Governmental Immunities Act as to whether or not the dismissal at the lower court was proper. And it was, because the Governmental Immunities Act says that claims that lie in tort or could lie in tort are subject to the immunity provisions. And the court looked at the underlying allegations and said, you know what, the plaintiff could have brought these in tort, didn't, but could have, and therefore immunity applied. Then it went to the question of attorney's fees under 201 and said, for purposes of 201, especially with respect to the issue of tort or contract, we're going to allow the parties to designate their own claims. So she brought a claim in contract, and that's important because parties ought to be able to freely contract and allocate risk and costs within their contract. So the court said because she designated them as contract claims, Section 201 does not apply because it only applies to torts. That doesn't end the analysis, because the statute says occasioned by tort, as Your Honor pointed out. That's where we go to Aztec Minerals. And what happened in Aztec Minerals is the plaintiff brought four claims for relief, two common law tort claims, and then two constitutional claims, one for trespass and one for due process. in arguing against an application of Section 201, the plaintiff said, can't do it because we've got two claims that aren't tort claims. The court said, no, you don't stop the analysis there, but instead you look at the underlying allegations. And in that case, the court found that all four claims really were tort claims because they were either expressly characterized as torts or they were dependent on allegations of tortious conduct. In other words, they were constitutional torts. And for that reason, the court said plaintiff's allegations were occasioned by tort, and therefore Section 201 applied. It's also important to go back and look, I think, at the Deceptive or the Consumer Protection Act and what that statute is. And at its core, at its base, it is a Deceptive Trade Practices Act. It's a tort act. And we know that by looking at the language of the court, of the Supreme Court, in Rhino Linings, where it says a breach of contract claim without additional conduct cannot constitute an actionable claim under the CCPA. Breach of contract is not sufficient. You need additional conduct. That conduct is tort conduct. That's tort-based. Moreover, Crow says the crux of a CCPA claim is a deceptive trade practice which must be intentionally inflicted on the consumer public. The CCPA in and of itself is a tort act. And therefore, not only were the misrepresentation claims that were characterized as misrepresentation claims tort claims, but so are the claims under the CCPA. Mr. Jodko talked about the Crow case. I'd like to try and clarify that. Because at no point in Crow is the court saying that a CCPA claim isn't a tort claim. Rather, what the plaintiff in that case was arguing is, geez, if you apply the CCPA here, every malpractice claim is going to turn into a CCPA claim. And the court said, no, that's not the case, because what the CCPA requires is public harm. So it's a tort of a greater magnitude. It seems counterintuitive and can't be part of the legislative intent to say that because there's more harm, more people are damaged by your tortious conduct, by your misrepresentations, that somehow that takes those claims outside the realm of tort law and outside the realm of Section 201 and the mandatory fee provisions. The next section or requirement under the statute is that there be a dismissal based on 12B before trial. There's absolutely no question that that's what happened in this case. Judge Craven dismissed based on lack of jurisdiction under 12B1, saying that the complaint really shouldn't have been in district court at all, that the allegations, if they were to be made anywhere, should have been made in front of the Colorado Public Utilities Commission. Now, it's true that Judge Craven looked at extraneous evidence, but several cases, Trinity, Aztec Minerals, Snowmass, and others, make it perfectly clear that for purposes of a 12B1 determination, for determining whether or not there is jurisdiction, the court can take on extrinsic evidence to satisfy itself. Judge Craven did that here, made it very clear that his ruling was based on 12B1, not 12B5, and so that dismissal was proper. It wasn't a summary judgment, and therefore it's subject to Section 201. Lastly, Section 201 says that if those three criteria are met, that attorney's fees and award of attorney's fees are mandatory. Judge Craven properly analyzed the statute in the case, properly dismissed under 12B1, and that dismissal was upheld, and he did the proper thing and awarded Kinder Morgan its attorney's fees as he was required to under the statute.
Counsel, let me ask you if I could, because you've got a little bit of time. Would you address your colleague's argument, Mr. Jatko's argument, about the interplay between 1317-201 and the CCPA's attorney fees provision? I mean, on the one hand, The CCPA statute encourages the filing of tort claims. It's seeking to encourage private attorneys general and get their fees. Of course, 1317-201 is aimed at discouraging, you know, non-meritorious tort claims. How do those fit together?
Sure, and I can address that in two different ways. One argument that Aspen had made was to invoke the maxim that the specific should be utilized to the exclusion of the general. Those cases all really involve when you're talking about the same type of conduct. So you have the Ski Safety Act and a death under that. That applies as opposed to the wrongful death statute more generally. Here you really have two totally separate policies. Under the CCPA, you have an attorney's fee provision for frivolous and vexatious lawsuits, which in part stems from the fact that the CCPA is a powerful weapon in the hands of plaintiffs. You can get treble damages, you can get attorney's fees. So that's one policy issue. Section 201, on the other hand, is really part of the tort reform litigation, and you don't want improper claims filed in tort claims in your district courts. So if a claim is dismissed under 12B before trial, attorney's fees are awarded. Again, those are the general and specific doesn't apply because you have two separate tracks, two separate policies. Moreover, once you have that, the rule is you apply both statutes unless they absolutely conflict, and they don't here. And this case is a perfect example of why they don't conflict. Kinder Morgan made a motion to dismiss under 12B1. That was granted. It asked for attorney's fees, saying, one, under the CCPA, that it was frivolous and vexatious, and also under Section 201. And the court said, no, I'm not going to grant them under the CCPA because I don't find it to be frivolous and vexatious, but I am going to grant under 201 because I dismissed under 12B. The converse could easily be true. A claim could survive a 12B motion, go to summary judgment, and be dismissed at that point, and a court could then rule after hearing evidence that it was frivolous and vexatious, award on the attorney's fees under the CCPA, but it wouldn't have done that under 201. So both policies can be effectuated simultaneously. There is no conflict, and for that reason, the Section 201's attorney's fees should apply notwithstanding the provision in the CCPA. Unless your honors have any other questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Jatko, you have a little over 5 minutes left.
Thank you, sir.
I don't want it to be taken that we have abandoned any of the other arguments in our brief. We have urged that there was a Rule 56 treatment. Attachment C to the opening brief is an order or clarification of the record by the trial judge saying that this, I'm going to treat this under Rule 56.
Counsel, I guess I don't understand your argument. Didn't the judge after that issue an order that made abundantly clear his ruling was under 12B1?
Yes, but before, it gave us no chance to respond, is what I'm saying.
Well, no. I mean, you could read the first order, and I read the first order to say, I'm going to treat the 12B5 motion as summary judgment if I have to get there. But 12B1, the law is well settled that the court can consider matters outside the
Well, I don't think it's necessarily determinative what the court says in any event. There's an awful lot of material filed here. If it's not a summary judgment type of application, then I don't really know what one would be. In other words, I'm saying that the judge may have later said that he wasn't applying Rule 56, but that doesn't mean that you have to find that is correct.
Well, Mr. Jatko, under Trinity, the court held a hearing, taking testimony, went that far. It's like a mini trial, and yet the dismissal after a Trinity hearing is a 12B1 dismissal, is it not?
Yes. We do not abandon that argument, nor do we abandon the argument that Aspen's status as a home rule city exempts it from fees under Section 201. These are all arguments that are briefed. Now, I need to bring up another case. These computers are wonderful things, but this is a case of your own court in Division 4. Is the court aware of U.S. Fact Center, Inc.,
I was going to ask you the same question.
Yes, I'm aware of it. So you are aware of it. That answers my question. Yes, and was not cited by Mr. Llewellyn, but I feel I should draw it to the court's attention and tell you that this brings up what is to me the real nub of these cases. Even in the Facts Law case, if you look at page 11, as I have it marked on my printout, he relies on Dubray, and he says that the action must be primarily a tort action, as was the case in Dubray. Then, the part that Judge Marquez, you were referring to, I'm sure, is where he says that there is no conflict between 201 and the CCPA attorney fees provision. We respectfully and strongly disagree with that analysis. So I can't say anything more than that. I just want to make it clear that none of these arguments that we have not had time for today are abandoned or conceded. Now, along those lines, if I may, I agree with some of the questioning here that this does not quite seem like a rational system. I'll just tell you the way I think it should be, and because I think it answers some of the questions that the courts have been struggling with. Most of the modern litigation practice involves combined, or what they call combination, tort contract claims. I'd say a majority of the claims do. So in those cases, I think the courts are struggling to find some equitable application of 201. To me, the equitable application is if you file a bad tort claim, you pay for it. If you don't file a bad tort claim, you don't. And so what I would say is that rather than looking at what I consider to be sort of strained interpretations and reliance on pleadings, remember the Sweeney case, your court actually said this cannot be a contract claim. It has to be a tort claim. But we're still not going to apply 201 because it was pled as a contract. The guy went to the movies and the roof fell on him and he sued on his ticket. The problem he had was a limitations problem. But what the court said was even though he sued on his ticket, that claim was no good. But because he pled it as a contract, it was exempt from 201. I don't agree with that reasoning either.
How about the Robinson case?
How about it, sir? In what way?
That you look to the pleadings.
Yes. I think that's the way the law has developed. But I think it should be, as Gabriel has said, you should look at what the claim really is. And if it's a bad tort claim, you should apply 201. If it's not, you shouldn't. So in these mixed cases, this takes care of the problem where there's a tiny tort claim thrown in at the end of the case, such as our case. And then there's the whole bulk of the case is a statutory claim or, let's say, a contract claim. That's more clear. At the end of the day, if you apply this Torres case, that the attorney's fees under 201 are applicable to all the work in the case, which doesn't seem to be fair. It's not a tort case.
Mr. Jacko, your time is up.
Yes.
We appreciate your arguments and the arguments of your opposing counsel. Case will stand submitted.
Thank you, sir.
And we'll issue an opinion in due course. And now we'll allow some time for